are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, March 2nd, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. And as we are wont to do on a Casual Friday, Cliff Schechter will be joining us to look back on this latest week in the era of Trump. Also on the program today, we will rerun a May 2015 interview I did with Barry Crimmins, who passed away yesterday, maybe the day before. So in memoriam, we will have Barry Crimmins on this program. Meanwhile, West Virginia teachers offering a taste of potentially what a post-Janus life could look like as their wildcat strikes continue. Meanwhile, conservatives freak out over Trump's gun lies, but the NRA is not worried. Trump imposes aluminum and steel tariffs, probably. And a crap show probably to follow. Meanwhile, Georgia votes to punish Delta for not offering an NRA discount. Not kidding. Tammy Duckworth expecting, and the Senate can't handle it. And Ivanka may be on the precipice. Alex Jones may be also on the precipice. And McMaster likely to exit shortly. All this and more on today's program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is Casual Friday. If you are watching this program, you will know that I am wearing a soft-collared shirt in celebration of Casual Friday. Oddly enough, Michael is dressed to the nines.
Looking spiffy.
I didn't even know you had that top button look going.
No.
I
don't usually do it.
I've never seen you.
Usually
you do
actually
it.
On the opposite end of the spectrum.
For some reason on Casual Friday, you spiffy it up, but that's okay.
Michael prefers to think of it as Contrarian Friday.
Just noticed.
Lay down a hoof pathway of fire. You missed that. That Gorka clip where he suggested teachers lay down a path of fire.
Here is one of the least surprising headlines of the day. Trump confidant Carl Icahn dumped $31 million worth of stock in a company heavily dependent on steel last week.
That guy's a genius.
It's funny. What a coincidence.
It's almost like...
He just gave me a bunch of advice about this, too.
He's like Miss Cleo. He sees the future.
There you go. So, all right. The really exciting news, aside from the fact that it appears that Steve Bannon is sitting somewhere in his bathtub full of some type of form of boric acid. And
that's how I sit.
He is...
that's where she's going to go.
He's got to be enjoying the problems that Jared Kushner is having. We will get into that, the new story from The Intercept.
Little Jew having trouble. What?
I really...
someone get Robert Kuttner on the phone.
People don't remember, but Bannon threatened Kushner almost publicly. I guess it was back in April of last year. So
this isn't Hebrew school. This is real.
Yep. Anyways, but more important is what's gone on in West Virginia this week. In West Virginia, there was a strike back in 1990 where I think it was 44 out of 57 counties. You had school teachers striking. Subsequent to that, the Attorney General of West Virginia said that such a strike was unlawful. Slightly different than illegal, but unlawful. And if you heard any of the conversation we had with Ann Hodges the other day in regards to this Janus case, which is a case that involves public sector unions, and the idea that a non-member of the union who has to pay for the union negotiating on his behalf is having his First Amendment rights infringed because their collective bargaining is in some way implicates a political speech. It's a rather tortured argument. However, if it is successful, it's going to be very, very hard for anyone to argue that if actual bargaining with a state entity is compelling someone else's political speech, it's going to be very hard to argue that picketing and striking is not political speech that would be protected under the First Amendment. And if the state does not have an overriding interest in allowing collective bargaining, which may, if you want to argue that, compel someone else's free speech, then certainly they don't have an overriding interest when it comes to people who are striking against them. So, because that's just part of bargaining. I'm going to withhold something as part of this negotiation. So it's going to be interesting. However, and that's why this what's happening in West Virginia is so important. Because in West Virginia, on Wednesday, it appeared essentially that the Republican governor and the Republican state house had basically folded to union leadership demands. And supposedly the reason was this, but the fact of the matter is I have a feeling it was some other things. But this is an exchange between a guy named a kid, a 12-year-old kid, Gideon, I think it's Taylor. Is it? Let's just call it. We'll call him Gideon. And Governor Justice, who apparently is a fairly corrupt guy himself, but
yes,
is on stage arguing as to why he would expend money for the Tourism Bureau, but not the schools when they have some of the lowest paid teachers in the entire country.
Son, what's your name?
Gideon Chase Glover.
An investment in West Virginia tourism brings in instantaneous money, instant money, that I could help you with. If you throw it away, how smart are you being? If I put $20 million in tourism, it turns into $160 million. That costs $20 million, I'll take that away. I got $140 million extra dollars. Look what I could do for you. If you don't put it in there, don't put it in there at all. Now, just listen, if you don't put it in there at all, you're not going to have any money over here.
If you put money in schools, you're making smart people. And if you have smart people, you can make more smart investments.
Now,
so the governor, who I would also recommend maybe next time wants to sit in front of a table with a
hungry.
I just think that, like, I don't know.
Comfy shoe.
Maybe
governor.
Maybe a taller, maybe like a taller chair, just something that looks just a little bit more formal.
A little more respect.
Anyways. But supposedly, according to the governor, this is what turned him around. And it may very well have been this argument, although one would like to think that someone who has been in reached the point of being a governor of a state would understand the idea of investing in education.
Maybe he's just really into Disney movies. Like, he's like, right. You know, the kid asked me that question, and I changed the whole darn
but
policy.
I think what he also realized was that he had a room full of people who were cheering the kid on, and the teachers were not losing any steam. So they made a deal with the union leadership, and the union leadership secured a small pay raise. They went back to their rank and file, and the rank and file said, no way, because our healthcare costs are going through the roof with the healthcare plan that we're on. And so everything that you're going to get us in terms of a pay raise is clawed back plus more. And so what happens today, they are still on strike. Here is a clip of some of those West Virginia teachers protesting at the Capitol. This was back on the 26th? But this gives you a sense of what their issues are. They are the, I think, like 48th in terms of payments for teachers around the country. Here we go.
I just came to support my fellow teachers and state workers because we all need pay raises and to fix our health insurance.
A lot of teachers work second jobs. We live paycheck to paycheck. We went to college. We got degrees. It just seems like we are not respected anymore. And the same with state employees. You look at Department of Highway employees. If they decided they weren't going to get out and take care of the roads on snowy days, no one would get to work. But yet, we're at the bottom of the totem pole.
Here in the heart of the $1 million or $1 billion coal field, we're from coal country. And my daughter had asked me, she said, you know, Mom, she said, if this is the heart of the $1 million coal field, why doesn't Williamson have skyscrapers? You know, why is it so poor? And we've allowed these coal companies in the past to come in and rape and rob our land and kill the men who worked for them and gave them nothing in return, left nothing for the communities.
I think with the current administration we have, they think if they keep people uneducated, that there's more control over the masses. Legally, we can't strike, but at least we stand together, and there's no way they're gonna fire all these teachers that were here today.
I mean, this is, it's a big deal for a lot of reasons, not the least of which you see these teachers bringing in other issues from their communities. And so, I mean, this is, when people talk about social movement unionism, this is what they're talking about. They're talking about unions that are going out there and fighting for not just their narrow issue sets, their direct benefits, but they're fighting for broader issues in the community. And that's the way that you create that solidarity for people who aren't members of the union, for people who aren't teachers. And so very encouraging to see. And, you know, as the better it goes in West Virginia, the better it's going to go around the country. I mean, the Chicago teachers strike was very inspiring, I think, to a lot of unions around the country. And you saw people like Barbara Maldione get elected in Massachusetts on a similar platform that we saw in Chicago. So big deal. Big stuff. All right, we're going to take a quick break when we come back. Cliff Schechter, right after this. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is another casual Friday. And how do we mark the passing of another casual Friday? Well, we wait until the sun is in the high point in the sky in the east, and then we play this.
Cliff Schachter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schachter, Libertas LLC.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, Cliff Schachter, LibertasLLC.com. Hello.
Sam, how are you?
I am doing well. I am doing well, Cliff.
I feel like it's been so long.
It has been a long time. I have not. Fridays have been like complicated, and things have been complicated.
Oh, no, you guys work in some other folks, which is cool.
Working some other folks.
Also, because the last time
you were with Michael,
I got the pleasure of Michael Brooks. So you know, Michael Jamal Brooks,
indeed,
as I hear he's called.
Yes, that is the way he's branding himself these days. Now,
yeah.
Cliff. We have been doing this, I don't know, for how many years now. I should also say, folks, that we don't have that in the song, the Unprecedented Podcast, but people can check that out on iTunes, which I know you're doing on a weekly basis. But
yes, please do.
We have been doing these Fridays for, I feel like, at least 5 years. It could be six. I don't remember.
I think we're closer to six at this point. We actually were... I think I know where you're headed with this. We were on live the Friday that the horrible shooting in Newtown occurred.
Right.
We were kind of talking about that live, and that's December of 12. So,
wow.
I mean, you know, that's 5.5 years ago, and it's been a while, man.
And I think longtime listeners of the show will remember that you have worked for at least one or two gun advocacy groups. Your time. And, so this was, and this, I, you know, is a, an issue that I know that you have put a lot of time and passion into. And, I don't know. I want to just get your take. I mean, there is something that has been, I don't know if it will be meaningfully different, in the wake of the Parkland shooting, but there's definitely been something that's been different. And I just want to get your take on that.
Yeah, there's no doubt. This has been very different. I mean, starting with the fact that I think it's now been about 2 weeks, and here we are still talking about it. And of course, this being America, there is a shooting on the Central Michigan University campus today. You may have seen that. It seems at this point they're reporting that two people were killed. Nobody, no students. It was a domestic violence incident, which so many of those are what lead to these shootings. They're so tied to domestic violence. That's something we could do another whole other show on. But that we're just talking about what happened, you know, in Parkland. And, you know, there's a variety of reasons for that. One, I think, you know, I've said this a number of times. You think back to when Columbine happened, which is 1999. And nothing like that had ever really happened before. There have been school shootings, but nothing, you know, there have been a few of them where, you know, a few people have been shot, but nothing close to kind of that situation. And, you know, most of these kids, and I say that not I say it with respect, not disrespectfully, but I guess they are kids because I'm old, you know, in Parkland, they were being born around that time, you know. And so for them, this is the generation they've grown up in. Some people have called it Generation AR-15 or, you know, Generation sort of active shooter drill. I mean, they've gone through something that no other generation in American history has gone through, which is their whole lives. They've been essentially under the threat of when they walk into school, a disgruntled student showing up with military weaponry that they can get down the block, and doing something like what happened in Parkland. And I just think that has made them savvier about this than others have been. They also are of an age that they've had access for a number of years to social media.
Right.
We now know that, you know, obviously people can find out the way what's going on in other countries or what's going on in other cities or whatever in a way that they couldn't before. And I think they've had to go through all this, and yet they've, you know, they've probably, you've seen it since this whole thing happened, but probably beforehand had relationships, who knows, maybe with online with kids similar to them in the United Kingdom or Japan or Australia or Canada or Israel or, you know, Iceland or Spain, France, and seeing that other kids in high-income democracy don't live like this. They don't fear shooters coming in with assault rifles, which is essentially an M4, slightly modified to be semi-automatic, but essentially as deadly, a weapon of war, as many military people said. Somebody could just show up at your school and do this. I mean, so they're savvy with social media in a way that you can't, that, you know, that is, you can't just teach. They've lived it. But also, you know, some of this is the fact that they've been incredible. You know, I don't know if you've watched some of these interviews, but they're compelling. They have passion. They're talking about their friends, but they don't back down to anybody, including the president of the United States. I mean, right out of the box, they were basically telling him to F off, which I was kind of impressed by. But they can go on, you know, TV and they're very comfortable there.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Maybe that has,
I mean, I wonder, I mean, this is sort of like a tangential, but, I wonder if their exposure to social media has also just sort of, you know, had a more generic impact, that it is the right to speak out is more democratized. I mean,
I think that's right. I do. And I think it prepares them. They're not as intimidated, because on social media, you know, yeah, some people may have check marks and some people may have more followers, but everybody's essentially equal. You're all there tweeting. And there's just something to be said, you know, and again, I think there's downsides certainly to social media too. I'm not saying it's all good, but in that way, you know, again, I mean, look, I don't know what you've seen, Sam, with your kids. You know, I now have an 11-year-old and I have to sort of say certain things to him and make sure he's, you know, watching out for certain stuff, because they've got, they text each other and they've got ways of communicating through games they play and everything. And they're just looped in a way that I wasn't close to at that age.
Right.
You know, I didn't know what was going on with, I mean, they've got people they're talking to online and they're finding out stuff about it. I mean, you know, we were in New York for a year ago, Thanksgiving, and my kid was sitting there doing the video presentation in his class, because we had to miss a day, with one of the students, and he was reading the part of his poem from our hotel room in New York City, and his partner was reading it from their classroom here in Cincinnati. It's just a different world. And I think that means that you know, some of it might be luck that we just have that there are a couple of kids here that happen to be incredibly articulate, incredibly smart, and comfortable in front of the camera. But I think a lot of that is generational. I think these factors have something to do with it. So the NRA hasn't been able to pull their usual thing, or you know, Marco Rubio, and just offer thoughts and prayers, or not say anything, or just tell them basically to shut up. They have responses to all of that. They shamed Marco Rubio in that town hall.
Right.
His approval rating nosedived into the 30s to a place it's never been before, you know. And so you're seeing the result of it. You're seeing certain conservatives get frustrated because they try to go after these kids and they lose on any exchange. They can't just sort of be like, I'm older, respect your older, shut up, you know. And so I think that's made a real difference. Sadly, the little kids in Newtown, the ones who survived, weren't able to, you know, weren't in a position to go on camera and be able to speak the way these kids are.
Right. And it was, even in 2012, it was a different era in terms of social media. And what else, right. You know, there's another, aspect of this that seems somewhat different. And I don't know that it's unrelated from how outspoken the kids are, the students, but that... And, you know, this isn't this would not be my first choice in terms of how we deal with this issue. But it is, you know, you go with the the opportunities you have. The NRA is becoming somewhat toxic to corporate America.
Yes.
Not totally, but somewhat toxic. For instance, REI.
That's reported.
Yeah, REI basically stopped selling Camelback water bottles, Bell bicycle helmets, Giro ski goggles, because they're owned by Vista Outdoor, which is a broad-based, I guess, like retail holding company or something like that. And they make gun and ammo, they own gun and ammo makers, and they have a strong connection to the National Rifle Association. And so REI has done that. And we had Dix, of course, said they're going to stop selling semi-automatic weapons. You have, these aren't going.
So the Dix thing, though, is even bigger, I'll say, because please, they're one of the biggest guys out there. And not only do they say they're going to stop selling assault weapons, but they raised the age to 21, which then Walmart and L.L. Bean and others, Kroger and others that sell handguns, and no Kroger did that, but in any case, followed that. But the bigger deal was, to me, even than what they did there, is they actually they put out a platform calling for legislators, for lawmakers, to pass a number of reforms, among them the most popular ones, universal background checks and banning assault rifles. And, you know, people, we can pretend that corporations don't have an influence on this stuff, but they really do in history. We know when corporations start pushing for civil rights, because whether it's for the right reasons or not, they're going to lose African-American consumers, things change. The biggest one, of course, in the last 20 years is gay rights. When companies started offering domestic partner benefits and stopped being sort of threatened and felt that they didn't have to respond anymore to the threats of these right-wing ghoul organizations like the Family Research Council in D.C., because they realized the generation was coming along, especially the people they wanted to buy their product, who were different. And that's what this feels like. Because you've seen, airlines, restaurants.
Speaking of airlines, I mean, the Delta.
Yeah, incredible.
Yeah. So Delta basically stopped. I mean, the NRA is like, it's a one part trade organization, one part Groupon, right? They have they have their deals that they make with the gun manufacturers, but to get their member base, they got to offer perks. And I guess one of those perks was like a discount on Delta Airlines, which is,
yep.
I mean, I didn't realize that the NRA got you. Like, I don't get a discount on Delta. I'm a AAA member, I don't get a discount.
We're one of their hubs here in Cincinnati, and they moved to. But yeah, they do that. And then,
well, they stopped.
You're going to mention what Georgia did.
Yeah, they stopped offering this discount to NRA members. And then the lieutenant governor of Atlanta, who is also, I guess, the president pro tem or something like that of the Georgia Senate, said that if the airline did not restore discounted fares to members of the NRA, this is amazing. This is amazing.
How is this not extortion?
I
don't understand how it's legal.
Like, I mean, Republicans would strike down a $50 million sales tax exemption on jet fuel from its larger tax cut package. Now, look, I got no problem with them not exempting Delta, but to make it for a state to require a corporation to give a discount to a group of private individuals. It's just stunning to me. I'm trying to think of a scenario where I would feel like I could even justify this, even if I liked everything that was happening here, even if it was like,
that's the way I felt. I was like, I mean, you know, I silently would probably be like, that's awesome if it happened to somebody I didn't like. But I also would realize and state quite publicly that it doesn't seem legal. I don't understand how that's not extortion. I don't understand how the government can say you must enter into an arrangement. Private corporation must enter into an arrangement with this. I guess we still consider it's a joke, but the NRA, a nonprofit group, with this nonprofit organization, or we're going to punish you. I would think if they just did it and didn't say anything, I would think that Lieutenant Governor could be sued. I really would.
This is,
I mean, the legislators can claim. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, in addition to the like sort of the questionable legality of it, you got to wonder just like, is this an indication of the effect or the concern that the NRA is feeling about this? Because, I mean, I think like we have yet to, first of all, how many times have we talked about this stuff? How many times have we talked about the NRA? And now we're finding out, you know, this time that they had a deal with Delta, that they had a deal with a bunch of other stuff because people are backing out of this. And right. So
yeah, I had no idea.
And
I knew they had some deals out there. I was aware of some of the with some companies. I had no idea about that and some of the ones with airlines and that kind of thing.
And of course, now I think the cat's out of the bag. You're going to see people go directly at these corporations and say, you're choosing a side. Are you going to enable the NRA to do what it does? You know, because every discount you give goes into their essentially adds to their coffers for their ability to lobby to have more weapons, to have reciprocity. People can take their handguns across state lines. I mean, all of this. And I think this is going to get more sophisticated. The other element, and we've talked about this in the past, was it took a couple of days, but within a couple of days, we started seeing profiles of the CEO of the formerly Smith & Wesson, now the American Outdoors holding company or whatever it is. And so I know what the CEO of the manufacturer of that weapon looks like. And I think that's a very healthy thing, too. You know, if you're going to make your money.
Well, they can't sort of hide in anonymity. You know, I mean, we've talked about this and we've agreed very strongly and accepted this for a while. And frankly, you know, I don't know what to say about funding on the left that doesn't, you know, I mean, it should have been plainly obvious. And when you're dealing with the NRA, and I've made this argument privately to funders as I have here, which is that people needed to know who they were. They were, you know, riding on a reputation, you know, tied to sort of hunting and education about guns, whatever, that has nothing to do with what their mission is today. It really hasn't anything to do with their mission for about 40 years now. And we were letting, you know, the guy who founded the modern NRA murdered somebody. The legal counsel murdered his girlfriend's parents. Like, there's people on their board that openly supported apartheid. There's, you know, there's Ted Nugent. That's a whole category in and of itself. You know, there's, I mean, we could go on the whole show about that guy. I mean, the point is that when you look at just the rogues gallery of their executives, their board members, you know, it was sort of like this. It's not difficult if somebody will put the effort in to toxify these guys. You know, people just need to know. And now these kids are sharing this stuff. Again, maybe it's disrespectful for me to call them kids too, so I should call them students. They're sharing all of this. And the rest of us who've been out here doing this stuff, you know, are amplifying it as best we can. And so more people are learning who exactly the NRA is. And they are. That's the reason why, in the end, that they have become so toxic. And that's why you've had legislators back off and even float things, you know, like raising the age to buy assault weapons to 21, which isn't, of course, close to near enough. But the fact that you even had Marco Rubio say he'd support that, and I think was it Pat Roberts of Kansas say he'd support that, and a few others, is kind of a big deal, you know, and that you start seeing sort of, because they start getting worried because they're seeing what's going on with their numbers, and they all know with the election coming in 18, you know, they've got groups that are right out there right now looking to register 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds, realizing that we may have an explosion in voting among that age group like we've never seen before. You know,
well, that's the interesting thing too, that we've had this conversation, is that while you see large numbers of people who are pro gun control, let's call it, the depth of those feelings are not as intense or as deep, I should say, or the intensity of those stances are not as intense as people who are rabidly pro Second Amendment. And as evidenced by when you ask people, you know, what issue is likely to be in your top two reasons for voting or for voting against somebody, you'll see
right.
people who are, you know, against gun control voting on that far more than you
that's
see
correct.
People. And that's been the issue. But if that cohort of 18 to 24 year olds, if this becomes an issue for them that drives them to the
a defining issue. Right. And this is about their lives. So it is a defining issue. I mean, it's schools that have become a favorite target, sadly, you know? And so they're just sort of saying, adults, you won't protect us or do anything. We're going to do it. And I could see all sorts of kids. If it becomes, you know, this, like, again, I got to stop saying kids, but if you see this, it becomes the culturally cool thing to do.
Right.
You go in and you vote against the Republicans who and the NRA, and the Republicans, of course, who support the NRA, because at this point it's almost interchangeable with just a few exceptions. You have your Heidi Heitkamp, who's terrible on guns, the only senator left who voted against background checks, you know, after Newtown, the only Democratic senator. And then you have a couple here that voted for some stuff, Susan Collins and Pat Toomey. But for the most part, your Venn diagram is almost one circle over the other
right.
of the NRA and the GOP at this point in time. And so it's not really hard to figure out who's for gun control and who isn't. And you really party label pretty easily tells you.
What's going to be interesting is to see if there are groups out there, because you have a lot of groups in this era, right? These that have come up, some you want to call them resistance, hashtag resistance groups, or just people who have come up in the, you know, the wake of 2016, whether it's like Indivisible or Swing Left or even the DSA, which, you know, these are things that have grown significantly over the past year or two. I'm waiting to see if like the DSA or one of these groups like realizes like, hey, we could be sponsors for this movement, make it about this. And this is a way to introduce people to our politics. I mean, this is an issue that could
be
leveraged.
A smart thing to do.
It'd be a smart thing to do for, and you know, and for the Democratic Party
because,
or
look,
for, I mean,
well,
who knows?
Because look, I can be objective and honest about this, especially as somebody who did work, you know, I never worked for, which I think you said, but that's okay. I consulted for, you know, both Everytown, I consulted for Brady. But the thing is, to you know, our chagrin on some other issues, I mean, you know, Michael Bloomberg is an independent. He's not a Democrat, right? And there are certain places to kind of, because he has a very moderate image, he's not willing to go.
Right.
And some of these groups, like Indivisible and others, that are, if they're willing to take up this banner, because this is what was always needed. That's part of the whole toxify the NRA. make the names of who these guys are famous, who run these gun companies, but also just sort of engaging in the kinds of tactics and strategy that makes some people that are centrists, quote unquote, uncomfortable. You know, that you need to go out there. You need to say some of these things like they are. You need to say, you know, this is a bunch of arms dealers who make money off of kids and police and other people dying. I mean, that's just a fact. All right. So, you know,
I have to say that, like, I want to say that I'm sort of bewildered by, but I'm not bewildered by, but I just feel like one could learn a very interesting lesson when you have a guy who is a billionaire, who has the ability to spend unlimited amount of funds, who approaches business like, I'm going to get this done. I'm going to find the most effective way to do this, and I'm going to do it. And there is a lesson about ideology and about money to be gleaned from someone who's willing to spend that much money, but not engage in what is clearly the most effective tactic. Like, if I have
That's
to
right.
spend an extra $20 million to avoid doing this the way that is going to be most effective and get it done, I will do that. In fact, I will light all that money on fire at the end of this and not go to that place that makes me uncomfortable, because I don't want to demonize the corporations in any fashion whatsoever. That to me,
right. Or the individual players in this, or
yes.
certain Republicans that who support other things I support because I've got other issues. And, you know, and Gabby Giffords was always was a blue dog and a more moderate Democrat. And I'm not casting aspersions. I'm just simply saying they were never, you know, they're not comfortable doing the kinds of things. I mean, you know, I drive to the, I'm on the board of Planned Parenthood, and I drive there, and I got to live with, I got to see these people out there holding these pictures of fetuses and all this stuff. Who essentially, it's not a big deal for me. They harass women trying to go in there.
Right.
And we've decided that that's illegal. It really shouldn't be, as far as I'm concerned. I think it's harassment. And I think they can hold signs somewhere else. I don't think they should be allowed anywhere near the place women have to go to get treatment. But okay, we said that's legal. Why are we not outside, you know, on the public property, just far enough away from Mitch McConnell's house with pictures of dead kids? You know, because a bunch of parents have said they want those pictures out there.
Or the CEO of formerly Smith and Wesson.
CEO, yeah. Why are we not following them around? Why are we not using the tactic, those kinds of tactics, at the anti-choice movement with child-sized caskets? Why are we not showing up at their meetings, showing up and walking around and following Marco Rubio everywhere he goes, showing up outside their offices? Well, I think you're seeing some of that now,
yeah.
And I think you're going to see a lot more of it. And that's what was always needed on this. It's not to say that Bloomberg and Giffords, their money and their voice wasn't valuable. They're very valuable because there's no one out there before was doing anything, and they helped get a bunch of things done. They helped fund referenda, you know, in Washington State and Nevada and places that passed universal background checks. I'm not saying they didn't do anything, but for a while now, it's been quite obvious that a left, more aggressive flank that's not worried that what they think of us, or that we're going to see them at a party and they're going to disagree with us on something else, on some other issue, that we just don't give a damn. This is what we're going to do, and you're going to do, you know, we're going to use every legal measure that we can to annoy you and make your life difficult, and you know, or you're gonna represent democracy, and that, you know, so all of this has been huge. The poll numbers changing, and as you know, culture always changes before politics. We saw it with gay rights. We've seen it more recently with first medicinal, then recreational marijuana, and now I think finally we're seeing with guns. And I, you know, and look, I do have to say the one thing that bothers me about this, but it shouldn't take away from how important this all is that obviously I would be, you know, remiss if I didn't point out that this was a very wealthy white area when this happened. And America cares more of that. Okay. And that's just, I wish that were not the case. I wish that we were there as much, obviously, when this is the kind of, maybe not the mass shootings, but these shootings that happen every day in poorer and less white neighborhoods. And we've just sort of, there's no doubt we'd be dishonest if we didn't admit that that's a factor here.
Right.
But, the fact that to me, right now, whatever it takes to get this moving forward, I just think, you know, it's something where, you know, you can't, I mean, Parkland, the average house costs something like $900,000. Wow. So you can move to a suburb that you think is safe. You could move to a place where you think you've got the money, and you still can't protect your kids from the NRA. That's just a fact. You know, I mean, sadly, this is the first time there. I've known a bunch of survivors from Virginia Tech, family of someone who was murdered in Aurora, in the movie theater, and that kind of thing. But this is the first time it's ever happened to me, which is, you know, a friend of mine who's on, you know, who I know is on a board with me here in Cincinnati. Her niece was one of the kids young ladies who was shot and killed in that school in Florida. So I actually know somebody now who has lost personally, who I didn't meet after, but I've known for a while before, and I've seen it. And it shouldn't have to be that way, but I think that some of it's that a lot more people that have been okay to ignore this are going to know people and are going to realize that, yes, it actually can happen to them, that we're doing nothing to stop this, and there's just no reason why one disgruntled or mentally ill or criminally inclined kid who's at a school somewhere can't go to a flea market that weekend and buy military powered weaponry without a background check and then take it to school the next week. Everyone's vulnerable to it. All of us are. And I think that, you know, again, I'm not saying that that's the way it should be. It should have changed when it was affecting any of us, but you know, it is what it is. And now that I think certain people who never felt vulnerable this way are going to, it's going to change things too.
Well, let's hope. Now, look, we don't have too much time, but we should really just touch on the latest with Kushner. It really thinks. Jesus. I mean,
I think he may look may make Donald Trump look both like he has class and propriety.
No,
and maybe like he's a good businessman.
No, no.
I mean,
neither.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't. No. But he's as bad.
He's just like a little. Like, he's just like a little mini me running around there.
He really. It's incredible. It's like, hey, we bought a building 666 Fifth Avenue. Completely got in over our head. Don't know what in the F we're doing. So I think I'm going to go certain work at the White House so I can get meetings with all the kinds of people who I can sort of say, well, hey, you scratch my back, I scratch yours.
Here's the problem. Okay. I mean, here's the problem. The story from The Intercept, and you know, we've already heard that he's lost his security clearance. Supposedly Donald Trump is telling Kelly, John Kelly, will you get them out? Will you get my daughter and my son-in-law out of the White House? who knows? That could be they're just trying to keep distance. Hope Hicks just left the building, and another guy.
But if you believe Maggie Haberman, it was completely random.
Well, no, I mean, it could have been. It could have been. We don't know. We don't know. I mean, there's all sorts of reporting that
it could have been she was going to leave soon, and maybe that day was picked specific. But I mean, come on,
it could be she was going to leave soon, and she decided to leave earlier after her testimony. But the other thing, there's another guy. This guy Jaffel, I think his name was. He was Kushner's PR guy. He also left in the past 2 days, which supposedly he was contemplating. I mean, let's face it. Everybody in the White House is contemplating leaving at any given time. Yes. McMaster is supposedly rumored going to be out. So that saying that they've been contemplating it for months is like
That's
saying
true.
They're also breathing air.
They've also been contemplating eating today.
Right. Exactly.
I gotcha.
But
here's the thing also, which is, I don't mean to, but I know we have very little time, which is, and now the FBI is now, for the first time that I'm aware of, investigating Ivanka herself.
Yeah,
which
you
is
know,
kind of a big deal.
That story, you know, that story, that's what the headline says. And if you read it, it's sort of like, well, they always investigate these things, but this one is really complicated. It's tough to know where, what, you know, exactly. But what is more relevant to me than what the investigation, that there's an, you know, supposedly an investigation going on, is because, you know, these things get investigated. We'll find out at the end of the day what the story is. What's more relevant to me is that I can hold in my hand a story, an exclusive that says FBI counterintelligence investigating Ivanka Trump business deal. That to me suggests that Ivanka has someone who is not friendly with her, who wants...
No, they're trying to get her out. Exactly.
Who wants people like me to know. And so, and I would say the same with Jared Kushner's, this story about Kushner and The Intercept.
But
the story is, let me just tell people what the story is. The story is that Kushner's dad, who runs the company that is in desperately needing millions, is there a B? I don't know. Of dollars of loans.
His dad spent a little time in prison too for, you know, like setting up his sister, was it? With
yes.
Was it his brother-in-law with another woman so that he could record it and extort him. I mean, they're nice people. These
right.
People. But go ahead.
So they had, in April of 2017, Kushner made a direct pitch to the Qatar's Minister of Finance, and then Jared Kushner's dad was there too. They were looking for financing for Kushner's 666 Fifth Avenue property. They had a couple of meetings over the course of a couple of days. They didn't broker a deal, and then a month later, Kushner is in the Middle East. Basically says to Qatar, screw you, gives backing to the Saudis and the UAE, which was a big diplomatic assault. Do people remember this? Like when there was like supposedly like documents released and Qatar was isolated, and Tillerson had basically said, we're going to slow down this blockade that that the Saudis and the UAE had begun. And Tillerson said, well, we're going to roll this back. And then, like, literally, like, a couple of hours later, Trump says Tillerson doesn't know what he's talking about. And Qatar is a bad place. And then he said that whole thing, like, they say you got to call it Qatar, but I call it guitar or whatever it is, like some dumb, like, and which suggests to me that now, look, it's quite possible that Kushner wouldn't have been involved in any of this had he gotten that loan. But it is very, very, this is the problem, right, folks, is that when, their ability to do business or make a deal or not interferes with our foreign policy decisions, that seems somewhat problematic. That blockade is still somewhat happening too. I mean, this is.
Remember when, like, they got all freaked at Obama over Solyndra?
That's right. Yes.
Just saying.
Supporting.
This seems a little more complicated. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you're right. I think. Well, obviously, Trump wants them out and I'm sure many others there want them out, and who the hell knows? It may finally eventually happen soon. But I just maybe there's rabbits Kushner can pull out of a hat. I don't really see how he doesn't go to prison though.
Well, we'll see. But Cliffy, as always, a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us this week, folks. Check out Unprecedented.
Sure.
All right, we'll talk to you later.
Thanks for having me.
Bye bye.
Yep. Take care.
All right, folks. And now don't do stuff like this generally, but I'm going to replay an interview that I did with Barry Crimmins from May of 2015. I haven't reviewed it. I just wanted to play it. I believe we're talking about the documentary that Bobcat Goldthwait made about Barry. I mentioned yesterday that he had passed away of cancer. The documentary was called Call Me Lucky. And I knew Barry from his time in Boston as a comedian. He was a, I was a young comedian, and Barry was sort of like larger than life in that comedy scene. He was one of the guys who built the sort of the late 80s Boston, or I should say early 80s, mid 80s, Boston comedy scene, which was a big deal at the time. And then he went on to, was performing with him at a fundraiser in the context of Cross Comedy, which was this group that David Cross and a bunch of other comedians had, we would all sort of put together. And Barry announced for the first time publicly that he had been sexually abused as a small child. And after that, he became an activist to protecting basically kids from pedophiles, particularly on AOL, which was at that time a sort of burgeoning sort of like online community, not just about email. And he testified in front of Congress. Later, Barry and I worked together at Air America. He had been performing. Apparently his last special is really great. I haven't seen it. But here is that interview from, I believe it's 2015, Barry Crimmins. Here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a real pleasure for me to welcome to the program someone who was on the original Majority Report on Air America at least a couple of times, and I know on some of my subsequent shows on radio, and I don't frankly know why it has taken me this long to have him on this program. Barry Crimmins.
Neither
do I. I honestly, Barry, like I was like, wait a second, is it possible that we haven't had Barry on? And it's ridiculous. And so let me just say that was a mistake, and We're going to have you on as, you know, more often, hopefully, if you will, if you will come.
Anytime. Love the show.
Now, let me just, I want to just tell people, you know, and I don't know
Can I get in two comments on what you were already talking about today?
Sure, please.
First off, I think it's clear that Jeb Bush at least believes in political climate change. And secondly, the only intelligence that could have kept us out of the Iraq War was Native intelligence. So, thank you.
Indeed. And you know, I'll tell you something. Let me just back up for a second so the people, we can put this sort of in context. I started doing comedy in Boston in 1990-91. Uh-huh. And I was, you know, at that time, I think we were going into Kuwait for the first time or sometime around then.
Right,
maybe it was
a little bit
later.
Right.
And
it was World War I of the Gulf Wars. It was the, if you hadn't had that one, you wouldn't have had to have any of the subsequent ones.
And in some ways, it was sort of like a training ground, too, I think, for the American public as to what we were willing to do in that in the Middle East. But you were one of the few clubs I would do open mics at was Catch a Rising Star. And you were a huge force in Boston comedy, certainly way before I got there, with starting the Ding Ho. And if anybody knows anything about comedy, the Ding Ho is a legendary place where guys like Stephen Wright came out of, and Meany and Lenny Clark, and that was a room that you ran.
I started it, yeah. Produced the shows.
And for me, and I don't know if I told you this when we were at Air America together, but so much of what I did at that time and so much where I started in comedy sort of came out of just, you know, I don't think I took any of your material, but you were an inspiration insofar as, like, what could be done on a comedy stage. And very few people were doing what you were doing at that time.
Yes, and considering how it worked out for me, we understand why. But no, but then again, I was doing what I was supposed to be doing, Sam, and everybody should do what they're supposed to do. Like, you figured that out and you did it. And I'm glad that what I did served as an indication that you could certainly go ahead and do what you were going to do. But a lot of comics apologize to me for not doing my kind of act. It's like, no, you're really funny and you do what you do, and that's great. You know, that's, I don't expect everybody to do what I do. It's hard, and, you know, people don't want to hear about it a lot of the time.
Yeah, well, I mean, and you know, I would watch you in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which was theoretically, right, the least hostile place, I think, for the things that you were talking about. And there were still times, even in the basement of a place in Harvard Square, where you were met with some hostility.
Sure.
But let me get your sense. I mean, I want to talk about some other stuff, too, obviously, and Call Me Lucky, the film that of which you're a subject of. But do you think it's changed? I mean, my sense is that, and particularly, and I should also say that, we ended up at Air America together as well, where you were writing for all, you know, many of the shows there. And even then, there was a lot more hostility to comedians being political, it seems to me. I mean, do you think it's changed?
Well, here's the thing, Sam, and this always sticks in my craw, and that is that if you're progressive and you're political as a comic, you're labeled as political. But if you're reinforcing the oppressive status quo, if you're misogynist, if you're racist, if you're, oh, you're just fun. And it's not, that doesn't count in the political spectrum. But if you go out there and you make jokes about, you know, beating women or, you know, whatever it is, that's a political statement as far as I'm concerned. And if anything, you know, the vast majority of political statements that are made on comedy stages just aren't progressive statements. But they're not labeled as political.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it's because the oppressive status quo isn't threatened by them, so it just seems normal and part of the fun. And you're just reinforcing stuff and pushing easy buttons and so on and so forth. And in a lot of cases these days, you get to be called a rebel because you're really in favor of just, you know, the world still being based around white guys who grew up in cul-de-sacs.
Right. And there was a lot of that, like, I mean, that, to a certain extent, that I feel like that grew out of, like, the 80s on some level. And sort of, I don't know, like P.J. O'Rourke, like that, all that stuff.
Well, there's always going to be a backlash, and the reactionaries never willfully give up a piece of turf. That's why we now have a civil rights movement for bigots. You know, they just won't give up. When you beat them, you know, you have to hold the ground, and we often think, oh, okay, well, everybody's sort of on board here. Give it some time, and they'll find ways to come back at you. I think that will certainly happen with, you know, a lot of the progress we've made on issues concerning sexuality and gender, so on and so forth.
You know, it's funny. The other day I was at, occasionally I go on MSNBC to do some talking head segment.
Right, right.
And I was on, and I was in the wings of the set when Judith Miller was walking off the set with Chris Hayes. And the first thing I thought about was what I think it was the title of your book, even. And that story that you told. Tell that story, because it literally, that resonated in my mind.
Okay, so I'm at CNN one day in like 88. And I'm in the green room, and I'm talking to Norma Quarles, who was an anchor there. She's getting ready to go on in an hour or something. And I'm getting ready to go on. And just then, and she's being very courteous with me, and we're having a conversation. I'm sort of standing up and pacing around, because it's what I do before I do any sort of performance. And all of a sudden, she just looks right past me and immediately gets inordinately obsequious. Oh, hello, doctor. How are you? And I turn around, and I see this person, and it doesn't register right away who it is, but I just go, ugh. And I start bootlegging around, and then a second later, I realize it's Henry Kissinger. It's Henry Kissinger. And at first, I'm going like, why? To myself, I'm actually thinking, why would you immediately hate him? Oh, it's Henry Kissinger. So I bootleg around the room. Kissinger's sort of by the door. So just to go to the far side of the doorway and to walk out of the room, you know, I bootleg all the way around the room and walk out, and at the door, and Kissinger's sort of just standing there kind of like idling like a satanic water cooler, just and so Kissinger extends his claw to me and says, "Hello, I'm Henry Kissinger," and I just look at him and go, "Ugh," and walk out of the room. And the next thing you know, this big phalanx of security comes up and whatever, because it's a big threat to Henry Kissinger if you don't want to suck up to him or shake his hand because he's high ranking in the cult of personality and let's forget about everything else. But, you know, I wasn't going to do that. So after everything clears and they take Kissinger into a special other room and with all the security and stuff, I could walk back in and Norma Quarles says to me, Why didn't you want to shake hands with Dr. Kissinger? And I said, because I have a strict policy of never shaking hands with war criminals. And she says, oh, that's right, I forgot. Well, I didn't, Norma. So, anyway, that's what
And
happened.
We should say, she forgot not that you had that policy, but that Henry Kissinger was a war criminal.
Yeah, I believe that was the case. It might be. I don't think she knew my policies. But
well, yeah. I got to say, that makes me feel a little bit better, because I was feeling guilty for not saying it to Judith Miller's face. Because I literally turned my back when she came through, which I don't know if she was savvy enough to realize, like, that's weird. He's in a 3-foot hallway.
I think he's got to be pretty used to it.
Yeah.
But it's amazing that she gets to come back.
Yes.
It's amazing that when they go over all this stuff and they realize all the mistakes in the Gulf Wars and whatever, you know, they bring back all the people who were wrong, and they're all, no one really knew at the time. Well, me and 10,000 people on the Boston Common knew.
Yeah.
You know?
I agree.
So,
all right, so.
So you should not, you know, I mean, turning your back to her, you don't have to make a big deal out of it, but just, I'm not touching you. I mean, towards Kissinger was just a natural reaction. Like, get that thing away from me. I don't want to touch you.
So let's talk a little bit about the movie. Like, I really want people to be able to see this, and we're linking obviously to Call Me Lucky, the movie .com, and there are screenings I know in in June in Detroit in Ann Arbor at the Cinetopia right. Film Festival, and
7th in Detroit, 13th, 14th in Ann Arbor, I believe,
and then the 26th of June at the Free State Film Festival in Lawrence, Kansas.
Right, and the 24th we're at the BAM Cinema Fest in Brooklyn.
Oh, really?
Brooklyn Academy Music, yeah.
Oh, fantastic! I didn't realize that at all. That's not on the on the website yet. So,
but I'm not in charge of that. But,
right?
Yeah, it's So we're going to be in Brooklyn, and that's fun. And then after that, and there'll be an announcement about how more people will be able to see it in the relatively near future.
Okay, good. And I just want to tell people.
And we've done great. We went to Sundance, and there were, you know, 5 sold-out shows and standing ovations after every show. And it's just, you know, and the critics were incredibly generous. And then we received the best documentary at Boulder. Best Doc at Gasparilla in Tampa, Audience Choice at Chattanooga for Best Overall Film, Best Doc by the Audience at the Independent Film Festival Boston, and then most recently the Chicago Critics Film Festival. We received the Audience again chose this as the best film of the festival. So
I'm not surprised.
Well.
I mean, I should just tell people it is a film that Bob Goldthwait made about you, and it was particularly fascinating for me because, you know, knowing you, knowing most of the people in the film, at least the comedians, you know, having been sort of like. A younger generation, and all of these, most of these people, you know, people I who were, you know, sort of that's what comedy was when I was in Boston. I don't know how much, you want to reveal about the film.
I don't think it should be like, it's not like you're spoiling, you know,
right.
a narrative film.
Right.
It's
okay.
A film. And, you know, I think people should know, and Bob said this, people should know that, it, among other things, it's about me surviving child abuse and how I dealt with it. And the reason it's called Call Me Lucky is because I feel very fortunate that who knows if I'd been abused a few more times or whatever, what would have happened to me? You know, I became a human rights activist rather than a human rights offender. So I'm really fortunate, you know. And then you look at that film and you see all these friends I have, and there's so many more like you who I would love to have in it. But as I tell everybody, it was Bob's film. It's just about me. I'm just extraordinarily fortunate. You know, I had a really tough thing happen to me early on in life, and it cost me a lot of time. But once I had the opportunity to do something about it, I did. And a big part of my healing was working on behalf of contemporary children and started learning to get out of my own way.
Well, that was the part that, I mean, now I was there that night where you first talked about this on stage.
And yeah, it was we're doing a benefit for the Southern Poverty Law Center
right.
while Los Angeles is still smoking.
That's right. You know? That's right. And I was trying to figure out what that benefit was off the top of my head. I could not remember. And in Cross Comedy, we had done some sketches and you came up and it was, I mean, I am still getting goosebumps. It was one of the most poignant, I mean, obviously it's a different, different experience for you than me, but for me, it's sitting in that audience to see that level of honesty and to see you work through that pain was a really intense experience. And
I only talked about it publicly that one time, and then didn't do it for another year until I wrote a piece for the Phoenix, Boston Phoenix, about it. But that night, it just seemed to me, with all these people really denigrating these kids in Los Angeles, I just felt it was important to try to say, you know, there's context here that we need to understand. You know, and as I've come on, gone on to learn, or really articulate better, and that is that when people behave, you know, in what looks to be an insane way, there's often reasons for it. And if you can get back to the source, there's sanity at the source. This seemingly crazy behavior, if you look at it in the context of where this person's coming from, suddenly becomes ingenious. It's a survival mechanism. You know, they're just hanging on, and this is all they can come up with, and they're trying. You know, you got to get past that point. It's really important to go through things and not around them. However, you know, it makes it easier to not take everybody so personally, you know, because, often when somebody's just irrational with you or whatever, they're just telling you something about them, not, right. You know, not you. They're telling you about some kind of pain or problem they have.
I distinctly remember that night when you, as a way of entering into, you know, telling people in this room, and you know, and it was in a comedy club. It wasn't, you know, not a 1,000 seat venue, but it was, you know, there was a couple of hundred people in there at least. It was full, definitely full, and. Yeah. And I remember you saying that people asked you why you were, I can't remember exactly, you know, I'm obviously paraphrasing, but why it was so important for you to do your comedy and to fight on behalf of...
Yeah, the unspoken for it. Forever I thought it was because I was a kid from a wealthy town, not a wealthy kid, but at least I grew up in a wealthy town with a lot of advantages in upstate New York. And I just thought I had, you know, I just thought I felt guilty about that or whatever. But, I mean, it turns out the compassion, the tuning fork for compassion was deeply seated in me because I knew what it was to be oppressed. I knew what it was to be almost killed, you know. So I realized that for years I went out and spoke for the unspoken for. And when the time came and it turned out I was one of those people, I had a choice to either be a hypocrite or tell my story. And fortunately, I chose to tell my story. And I think right now, even all these 20 years, 20 plus years later, Bobcat makes this beautiful film, and I think it's helping some people. You know, I know it is because I've talked to them and I'm dealing with them.
Well, I mean, there are people in the film who talk about how you directly touched their lives in that accord. And the thing that I didn't know was, and because I think this is when I had left Boston for a while, and that within a year or two from there, when you had moved to Cleveland, the footage of you giving testimony in front of that Senate hearing is... really unbelievable. I mean, and what AOL was doing at the time was really unbelievable. Just talk about that exchange.
They were profiteering on child pornography trading. And you have to understand that back then, this was 1995, you know, it cost $3 or $4 an hour to be on AOL if you're on over a certain amount of time. And a normal person, that would end up costing you $100 or $200 to be on AOL if you were pushing it. Well, these people were all spending, you know, $1,000, $1,200 a month on AOL, and there were hundreds of them. And it was because when exchanging these files of child pornography, which is photographic evidence of sexual assaults and abuse of children, and it's not kiddie porn, which sounds like the Bunny Hill or something. It's photographic evidence. As I said in the hearing, I wish everyone could see it. I wish no one could see it. But once you see it, you're transformed. I mean, you're either a creep or you're transformed, you know. And someone told me about these rooms, these member rooms on AOL, and I wander in, and instantly, without even saying anything, people start sending me files of child pornography, like as a quote-unquote good faith measure, expecting me to return my collection to them. Well, with the 2.88 baud modem, or a five, six, whatever they were, 56, you know, it took forever to upload one picture. So these people were spending a fortune, and AOL knew this. And I kept approaching them about it in good faith for months. And then I just realized, you know, I just figured it out, followed the money, and realized that they were doing it because there was, you know, a lot of money in it. So the cornerstone of that organization, as far as I was concerned, was, you know, covered in blood. And, I mean, if you see these photos, and they were just photos, you can just about see the humanity, you know, wafting out away from these children's eyes. I mean, it's really terrible. There's one image, I mention it in the movie, of a curly-haired, very distinctive-looking kid, and he's getting raped by this curly-haired guy who looks exactly like him. It's clearly a family member. And one of AOL's big things was, well, we have parental guidelines on there. Like, what if the parents doing the rape, you know? They were just, you know, trying to dodge it. But at one point, finally, what you don't get in the movie, but it was far into the hearing, and I had landed a lot of blows on this lawyer for AOL, and he was a little punch drunk, and finally says, look, I want to make it clear, we have a strict three strikes and you're out policy concerning child pornography. And I just said, you know, basically, yeah, I love baseball, but come on. It's a one-strike offense in any league.
When I came in this morning and was talking to my producers about the film, and because that you know, that was the one part that I knew nothing about, that exchange, right, and your role in really, I mean, fundamentally changing. Because if that doesn't happen at that time, and you also introduced some cops to the idea that even who didn't even have computers at that time of what was going on there, but that the idea that AOL would have had a three strikes and you're out policy for child pornography is unimaginable now.
And their representative says this.
Yeah, that's their stated policy. And, you know, that you know, if you believe that they're actually adhering to it, and it's not designed just to escape accountability for those people, that's unbelievable. And here's the thing, though, is I'm convinced that that would have been precedent setting had you not been...
No, we have zero tolerance about crimes committed by teenagers, but we have three strikes if there's, you know, about crimes committed against children.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Yeah. And so let me, I mean, ask you, you know, and so...
And by the way, I'd like to point out, too, that I'm, with all this and whatever, I'm not some, you know, I'm glad to say I didn't become some reactionary about this. I don't believe you should kill people who do commit these crimes. They should be segregated from children, but and I certainly don't believe in the death penalty, and I don't, there's another thing. I get a little floaty when I talk about this sometimes, but I'll get back to it. Go ahead, Sam.
Well, I you know, one of the things that you do that if people follow you on Twitter is that you, it seems, I think it is, on a daily basis,
yes,
you make a request of the Pope.
For excommunication, yes.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, say that again.
For excommunication, yes. Their big threat is they're going to excommunicate you. Well, I grew up as Catholic and suffered a lot of emotional abuse at the hands of an awful priest who turns out I was the only kid who got, everybody else begged off of having to serve these early masses every day. I had to go in there. So I lived near the church, and, you know, I basically served every morning mass for, you know, years at a time. And I mean, these are weekday masses. And it'd be a small group of people there, and this priest who just hated me and did everything he could to drive me on, because he had profiled me. You know, he put his hands on me, and I hit him with an elbow twice, three times. And then, you know, he tried to get me in his car, and I never let him. And so he knew, and plus I think he was afraid of my father. And so he knew the pond wasn't stocked as long as I was there. So he did everything he could every day on an altar to drive me away while these parishioners sat there and watched. You know, and I mean, this guy's literally condemning me to hell. I pour the water on his hand. Are you trying to drown me? And just like whatever it was. but often mentioning that I, you know, it's blasphemous to have this hellbound child on the altar with me. And so if you wonder why I have some problems with authority, it might start by getting denigrated on an altar every day. But later on,
and so wait, his plan was
guy,
to get
Father
you to...
Thomas Neri was one of the most savage pedophiles who harmed countless children. And I know a lot of his victims. In fact, I know of three who committed suicide. And so, you know, he died in, like right after the turn of the century. And when I talked to my buddies who survived his most savage abuse, we have a we say we're in the Hell Alumni Association. And, you know, when we mention Neri now, two words come to mind, extra crispy. So.
Right. Well, so wait a second. So he was basically trying to get you to quit. So that some other
to drive me off after point, yeah.
So that some other potential victim would take your place.
Yes. And so then one day I'm watching the news from New York, and Dolan's on. He's just the bishop, but he hasn't been a cardinal yet. And this is before all the stuff came out about what he did in Milwaukee to cover up and hide money and commit financial crimes to keep the victims of these kids from the deaf school. They made a wonderful documentary about called Mea Maxima Culpa. Well, they hid all this money. He got caught. There's a paper trail, whatever. If they caught the CEO of IBM doing this, the guy would be taken away in shackles.
Right.
This guy's the cardinal and probably one of the leading voices in the Catholic Church in this country. Well, anyway, he gets up that day and talks about the last pope and says, it's about time someone stood up for the poor last pope, who, by the way, ran the office where, because the Vatican is an independent state made so by Benito Mussolini in a sleazy deal in, I believe, 1929, they can, you know, all they had to do was put a bunch of evidence in diplomatic pouches, fly it to the Vatican, and then, you know, Ratzinger or whatever would review it. And he kept the lid on everything for a while. And then I think he literally became pope because, like, well, I've kept control of this far, but if somebody else becomes pope, I don't know what will happen, you know, and, oh, okay, you be pope. So anyway, Dolan gets up and gives this impassioned defense of Ratzinger. And afterwards, they're interviewing all the parishioners outside. They go, it's about time someone stood up for the poor Holy Father. And that's when I just tied the whole thing together. These people, these are the same kind of people who sat and watched this son of a bitch abuse me on an altar every day. And had they said something, how many other children would have been saved from far worse? And I got to listen to them talk about this as if the victim here is the Pope who covered it up for years. Yeah, give me a break. So, yeah, excommunicate me. That's their big threat. Good. You know, I'll know I'm in hell if there's a bunch of bishops and popes there.
Yeah.
By the way, the new guy, it's his job to change the subject and not the church. Everything, he's done nothing about the abuse scandal except buy time. And sent emissaries to the UN hearing on torture in Geneva that child rape isn't torture, and to say that he's not responsible for any priests who aren't at the Vatican.
Interesting.
So you're a mayor, okay? Why do you get all this ink then?
Let me ask you. Do you?
And by the way, his PR guy Greg Burke, former Fox News. Fox News correspondent at the Vatican.
Oh, geez.
This is the guy who sold us and shaped this whole campaign on what a progressive he is. So you take that for what it's worth. Like Greg Burke, who belongs to Opus Dei.
Fascinating. That's a take.
Opus Dei
just don't hear.
I love the band.
Right, exactly.
A little bit softer now.
Wow, that's fascinating. I had no idea about that. About the
so, yeah, go ahead, excommunicate me. I demand it.
They haven't, there's a great cartoon in the, animation in the film about, the Pope reacting,
it's another genius thing, Goldthwait. I mean, I put my life in Goldthwait's hands and I made a wise choice.
Yeah. The film is really, it's incredibly moving and it's really amazing. And let me ask you this, and I know in some ways I know that you... you answer the question, and it's in the title of the film. But yeah. I mean, do you have times where you feel like, obviously, your life would have been different if you you didn't, if it didn't intersect with that life of that guy who that criminal
died in prison, the rapist, my rapist when I was four. And
do you?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a degree of that, but I've let it. You know, I don't know. If there is some grand reason to this, I can't really understand why this happens to any children. But if it had to happen to any of them, you know, or it's happening to a lot of them, I don't know, maybe there's a reason I was one of them because, you know, I didn't die. I survived. And I'm someone who had, for years before I dealt with my own stuff, learned how to tell audiences about things they weren't necessarily there to hear, you know. So, I feel like I have some purpose there, and so that's okay. And as far as the rest of it's concerned, you know, a lot of people go through a lot of stuff, and we don't hear about it, and we don't know about it. And, one of the things I'm very fortunate about was I was able to work through what happened to me as a child and move on with my life and get to be a bunch of other things. I'm not just a child abuse survivor. I'm a political satirist, an activist in a lot of causes. I'm a guy who chops his own firewood. You know, I have dog and girlfriend, and, you know, like, things are great. So that's just one element of it. But sometimes something will catch you from the wrong angle, or something will hit you, or you hear a story or something, and it comes back. And I just, that's like, I have a big hunk of scar tissue in me, and once in a while you turn the wrong way, and ooh, that hurts. But, you know, I know what it is, and I know it will pass. And I know that maybe I'm going to get something from that that I can employ to try to do some good. You know? So it's okay.
Well, you know, a lot of what I do is a function of having intersected with you 20-some-odd years ago. And I know that's true for a lot of comedians in my generation. I mean, people who... have been influenced by you. And I really do think that, you know, I think we're living in an era where we're seeing comedians who are far more willing than they were 5, 10, 15 years ago come out and get involved in speak their mind in terms of politics. I think a lot of that, really genuinely, I believe this, is a function of being younger and seeing you do it years ago. And I really do sincerely believe that, and I just wanted to let you know that.
Well, thank you very much, and I'll just skip it back to Lenny Bruce and Smothers Brothers and Mark Twain and a bunch of people who showed me the same thing, you know.
And so I also wanted to say, you got to get a wider mall for your job.
You know what? I got to tell you about that. My leg was broken because they wanted the shots. So I said, I'll give it a shot. And when I go, this isn't working, it was because I'm standing on my left leg trying to swing. I hadn't gone to split a piece of firewood that didn't split in 8 years. And then they rolled the film, it's conk, conk. And I thought
your form was a little bit off on that, I got to say. And I was, he's splitting it with an axe, not a maul.
My knee was broken in two places, like,
oh, jeez.
Like, 8 weeks before that or something. And so maybe it was 12. But anyway, it was still hurting. And it was like the wind chill was in the 20s below that day. So it was really hurting. And and we did that after he had me haul that log up the hill.
With a broken leg?
Yeah, it was getting better, but it was still there.
Wow. Well, people have to see the movie to know what we're talking about. But Barry, yeah. Where are you? Are you touring at all? Are you?
I'm going to, and I'm looking. I'm working towards. I got a couple more film fests to do. I'm finishing up a book for Seven Stories Press right now, and between now and the middle of June, I have that, and then in the middle of June, we have three more film festivals to do. And then after that, I'm going to go out and start doing some dates, working towards shooting a special next winter.
Fantastic. Well, I hope you'll come back onto the program soon, and people can check out what you're doing. We'll link to it at Barry Crimmins. It's barrycrimmins.com, right?
Yes, absolutely. BarryCrimmins.com or at Crimmins on Twitter or Barry Crimmins on Facebook. You can find me, and please check in. And I'll tell you what, Sam, I'm thrilled and really flattered that what you had to say, and I'm glad that I was a good influence on such a good person who does such good work.
Thank you, Barry.
I'm proud of you, kiddo.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me. And I hope everybody gets a chance to see Call Me Lucky, and all praise to Bobcat Goldthwait.
Indeed. Barry Crimmins, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye. So that was Crimmins on the program from 2015. He passed away yesterday, and condolences to his wife and his family. Rest in peace. He was a really important figure. All right, we're going to take a break, head into the fun half of the program. We will see you there.